Succession number 20849, Reel 1.
Tom Packwood, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Northamptonshire, a little place called Great Harrowden, which is not very far away from Wellingborough.
Which year was this?
22nd of April, 1922.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a head gardener.
And did you grow up and have your schooling near Wellingborough?
Well, no, by that time we'd moved to another place in Northamptonshire called Brigstock. And that's where I'd done all my schooling, at Brigstock, Latham's Charity School.
What was that like?
It was very good, as far as I recall, you know, no problems.
How old were you when you finished schooling?
14.
So that would have been 36?
36, yeah.
Did you get a job then?
I got a job straight away. My father, who, as I say, was a head gardener, found me a job with another head gardener on a big estate called Firmin Woods, which was 3 or 4 miles outside of Brigstock. And I more or less acted as the head gardener's boy, going around with the head gardener and taking down details what had to be done so he could give his gardeners something to do, because he had quite a lot of gardeners there at that particular time. But of course, as the years went on, the war started, and so a lot of the gardeners had to go. So we were left with about 6 gardeners.
Did you join any organisation before the war, like TA?
I was in the, I think it was the Air Corps, was it? Yes, it was the Air Cadets, yeah. But obviously my education wasn't good enough for me to go very far with those. I was reluctant to be, you know, an observer. That's what the idea was, observer or an air gunner, but no way did they qualify for any of those.
Why did you go in for the air cadets?
Well, really, that was the only one that was going in our village at that time.
So what kind of things did you learn with them?
Well, I can't really remember a lot about it, you know. I think we learned to do a bit of navigation, and most of it was, you know, mathematics, which wasn't a lot of good to me.
Did you feel in the later 30s that a war was coming?
Yes, well, as I would say, I worked for this big estate, and after a while, you know, I was getting 10 shillings a week for 48 hours a week. In that nearby, Wimpy's were starting to build an aerodrome in a little place called Grafton Underwood, which was only about a mile and a half from Brigstock. Two or three of my mates were working there, and they said, well, why don't you come? So I asked for a rise at this particular establishment I was working at, and they said no, so I gave them a notice and left, and went to start and work in for this firm of Wimpy's building aerodromes.
How much did they pay you?
We got there 4 guineas a week for working 12 hours a day, Saturdays and Sundays. You know, so quite a long week, but there again, from 10 shillings to 4 guineas was a lot of money in those days.
Were you happy with working for Wimpy's?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. I started off there as a carpenter's labourer, you know, in the big sawmill, because they made their own wood screening and all this and the other. They also cut down the big oak posts in the farmyards and made furniture out of those. They had qualified men on site to do that. But most of Wimpy's men were from Southern Ireland. And every now and again, you paid your income tax in those days on a quarterly basis. And when it came to the income tax to be paid, these Irishmen disappeared back home. So there was no one to do the jobs that they were doing. So I learned to drive, you know, a lorry or van on the perimeters of the airport and the aerodrome. and also learnt to drive the smaller Caterpillar tractors, because, you know, somebody had to do the job while they were gone. And I managed to do it, because then again, in about 3 weeks' time, they would come back under another name and start working again for the same firm. But and then we finished that aerodrome, and of course we then moved to another aerodrome at a place called Enston, which was near, not far from Chipping Norton. And we started on that one, nearly finished that one, and then we moved down to Stony Cross, which was in the New Forest. But by that time, my calling up papers had arrived, so I had to join up.
How did you get on with these Irish chaps?
Oh, they were perfectly all right. I was in the same lodgings with them. They were perfectly, nothing wrong with them. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
they got away without paying any
income. They never paid any income tax. They used to disappear over back to Southern Ireland and come back in 3 weeks' name, under another name, and start again. Yeah.
Any way you could get out of it?
No.
Would you pay income tax at that level of wages then?
Oh, yes, you paid your income tax at those wages in them days, yeah. Yeah.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I heard that on the radio, yeah.
How did you feel about it?
Well, I can't say, I felt anything really about it, you know. I thought, well, eventually, I knew we were going to get called up, and so eventually I did get called up, and that was it.
So you didn't feel any sense of dismay about the war?
No.
When did you get called up?
I don't really know, we can't recall the date. I know I was in digs in Chipping Norton when my father wrote to me and said my papers had arrived at home. That was in Brigstock. So, of course, I had to leave and go there, and I was given so many days before you had to report to where it was you had to report to. And I had to report to Bodmin down in Cornwall.
Had the war affected you before that?
Not a lot, no. But by that time, the Americans had taken over the big aerodrome at Grafton Underwood with their flying fortresses. And, of course, when I used to go home, we used to get down into the local pub and used to meet some of them. But that's all I really knew about it, you know. Then you'd meet some of them one day, the next day they hadn't come back.
How did you get on with them?
Oh, perfect, you're right, yeah, no problem at all. Yeah.
Were they the same type of people that you were already familiar with?
Well, they were different, shall we say. I mean, out in the sticks where we lived, we weren't used to people that had all the privileges and stuff that they got hold of. So, I mean, they were different, but they were perfectly all right as people.
What happened when you got to Bodmin?
Well, we joined up with Bodmin, and I think it was about, I can't remember, the 16 weeks we had to do basic training, or six, I can't remember which it was about. But, of course, when I got there, going through all the tests, they found that I had pyorrhea, so all my teeth had to come out. So there I was at the dentist down there, one week having 7 out, another week having 8 out, which meant that I couldn't eat the food, you know, which was dished up from the canteen. So I was given a chit to go to the cookhouse to get more or less sops, stuff in a liquid form to eat. And so I eventually finished up with all my teeth out, and... For that time, me.
What did you think of the dentist work that you had done?
You didn't have much to say anything, you know. You're there, and there you whipped 7 teeth out at a time, and that was it, you know.
Did it hurt?
Well, I can't say it hurt a bit, but, you know, you certainly, mouth wasn't very pleasant afterwards while they were healing up. And of course, in those days, you had to wait for a long while before you ever got any false teeth.
Why was that?
Well, I think they made your gums had to harden in them days before they'd take impressions, not like they do nowadays. More or less put them in straight away. In them days, it was you had to wait some time before you ever got any teeth.
What happened next?
Well, after the basic training, we went home on leave, went back again to Bodmin, and I found that I'd been posted to the Somerset Light Infantry and was told to report to Leamington Spa up in Lincolnshire, which we did. And
how had you got on with the basic training?
Oh, no problems. No.
How had you been treated on it?
Oh, you were treated very severely, you know, you were kept up to the mark. Because the instructors were all light infantry instructors. And the one that was our sergeant in charge of us was a Somerset man, because the Somersets always wore their forage caps straight up, none of this one side or the other. It was dead straight. And so, of course, we had, ours was always dead straight with him. And it, so I was used to it. When they got to the Somersets, I don't know what battalion it was, I'm sure. But somebody said it might have been the 4th.
Was the hard treatment necessary on the basic training?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Yeah. It made men out of boys.
Yeah. In what sense?
Well, it taught you what you could do, you know, and the discipline about it.
So you went to Leamington Spa?
Well, we finished up at a place called Sutton-on-Sea, which was near Mablethorpe. And it was on the coast there. And you were only just more or less coastal defences. Not that there was anything happening much up there. After a while, the whole battalion was posted to Northern Ireland, because the Irish were still having skirmishes in, I think they called Black and Tans in those days. And we were stationed not very far from the mountains of Mourne in Nissen huts. And it rained most of the time. And the rain used to come in one end of the Nissen hut, run right through and out the other. So every morning you got up, your feet were wet. And a notice appeared on the board, volunteers wanted for airborne. So I thought, well, there's got to be something better than this. There's nothing going on here. And so we volunteered. I think 3 or 4 of us volunteered for the airborne.
Was it just to get away from...
Get away from conditions and that over in Ireland. And, of course, if you volunteered, they couldn't stop you going. And so we eventually finished up in... Bulford Camp.
Had you had any active duties in Northern Ireland?
Only guard duties, that's all. Yeah.
Was there ever any trouble for you?
Not really, not as I can recall, no. No. I mean, we never had no weapons. All we had on guard duty was a pickaxe handle with a nail in. They didn't trust us with rifles. Because I think whoever it was, IRA or Black and Tans, would have probably pinched them.
How did you get on with people in Northern Ireland, civilians?
All right, I think I used to go to local dances in the local village halls. I seemed to get on all right with them.
What village was that?
I think it's a camp. The one it was, I think it was called Bainbridge, I think it was. That was the nearest one to where we could get to, I think.
Did any of your comrades form relationships with the local girls?
Not that I know of, no. No.
So, what happened once you'd applied for airborne?
Well, once we applied, they had to let us go. We were transferred back over by boat and then by train and finished up at Bulford Camp. And three or four of us, and we were all posted into the Ox and Bucks, you know. And we all finished up, I think, in D Company, of the Ox and Bucks.
Which battalion was that?
Well, 52nd.
Can you remember any of the officers, NCOs or comrades in D Company?
Oh, yes, yes. I was in the same platoon right from start to finish.
Which one was that?
Number 24 platoon. With my officer in those days was a man called Danny Brotheridge. He was the first man who was killed on D-Day. He was my officer. Most of the men I can recall, because we were all in the same platoon all the way through. In fact, I think our platoon has still got most of the men left from the D-Day operation. Out of 25 platoon, as most of the men are still alive. They're in the first glider which landed.
What was this officer like?
Oh, he's very good officer. He was what we used to call one of the boys, because he had come up through the ranks, you know, and so he was a very good officer, really.
Who was your particular friend in the platoon?
No, never had any particular friend. I mean, I was always being a person on my own. Having been, on my own, more or less, when I was in working for Wimpers and that, and so I stuck to myself. I mean, I was always quite a good dancer, so most of my spare time was spent dancing down in Amesbury. Big dance hall. Well, there was a big dance hall there then, and a big local band, Melville Christie and his dance orchestra, and so they were playing there afternoons and evenings every day of the week. So every time I was off, I went down there to dance. I didn't go in to the naffies drinking, or I did go in, but not on a regular basis. No. I'd walk into Amesbury and have a few dances and walk back again.
What was the training like with the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry?
It was pretty strict training, yeah. Yes. But what did the man in charge, John Howard, he was a lot older than we were, but he never expected us to do anything that he couldn't. He would do the same as we did. He did not stand there. And so he was very interested in cross-country running. That was his passion. So I was only 10 stone 6 weight, so I was quite a good runner. So
how tall were you?
5'10", 5'9". And I made myself quite available, so it eventually finished up in his cross-country team, which gave you a lot of privileges, because many afternoons you'd go off for probably a 5-mile run, and then you'd be finished, and your day was over. The time you'd had a shower and a wash, you were ready to change to go out.
Any incidents that happened to you at this time?
No, not that I know. No. No, of course, the Ox and Bucks, doing all this different training, we were sent down to Ilfracombe for rock climbing experiences and landing from the sea, from things like that. And after we was finished down there, the Ox and Bucks had to march back to Bulford, which was 135 miles, and they'd done that 135 miles in 5 days. And D Company was the only one which had no casualties out of that particular, and the time we got to Bulford, John Howard said, march to attention, so which meant you have rifle at the trail as we marched into the barracks. And I think really, as D Company came through with that distinction, was why it got picked for this particular operation on D-Day because of the fitness of the men and at that particular time.
Did you have to carry rifles and equipment on the march?
Oh yes, you were fully equipped all the while, yeah. Yes, you had the Piat, you had a 2-inch mortar and you had brain guns and things like that, which all had to be carried.
What condition were your feet in?
Well, mine were quite all right, you know. Mine never had any problems with my feet, not blisters or anything. I don't know why. Some of the other ones really suffered with them, but I never had any problems foot-wise. After 25 more marches, you'd have a foot inspection. Mine would be perfectly all right, and I'd be get washed, changed, and off out. The rest of them, you know, had problems. Blisters.
And, what else do you remember from this time?
Nothing much, I don't think, really. Because we went down to Ilford Coombe twice on these sort of exercises. And then after a while, I mean, we didn't know we were doing exercises down in Devon, down a place called Countess Weir, which we didn't know what it was about at the time, but it seemed that was the only place in the whole of the country they could find two bridges which were similar to the ones we were going to attack on D-Day. One was a canal swing bridge and the other couldn't be a river bridge, it was a railway bridge, but those two were down near Countess Weir. So we were doing exercises down there, but of course not landing with gliders, and we were just jumping off the backs of lorries as the lorries went over there attacking the bridges. But I mean, Ross, it was just an exercise because the Polish airborne were the enemy on this particular operation.
And then?
Well, from then on it went to, obviously, up towards D-Day. I mean, we knew D-Day was getting close, but we were transshipped from Bulford Camp to a transit camp, which we didn't know where it was, but it turned out to be somewhere near the aerodrome of Tarrant Rushton. And there we were in this field with this and that, and only one stone brick building. I think that was actually the cookhouse, but the rest were just tents, and a big tent in the middle, which after a while we were taken into and shown what we were going to be involved with on when the D-Day started.
What were you shown?
We were shown a sand model of the actual area of what our operation was going to be contained in over the two bridges. And they were shown actually to the old of the six platoons of John Howard. Then after a while, each individual platoon commander who had been given his job by John Howard took his own platoon in there and showed them what we had to do. But of course, it would turn out it was three gliders for each bridge. But they never knew which one was going to get there first. So each three had to know three different tasks. If you got there first, you'd done this. If you got there second, you'd done this. If you got there third, you'd done that. But fortunately, as it turned out, they all landed in exactly the same sequence as they should do. So there was no one, everyone just done the job that they had been allocated to in the first position.
How did you feel once you learnt about what the objective was going to be?
Well, we'd been training for it all the while, you know. I mean, it was quite exciting, I suppose, really, you know, to think that we were going to... I mean, we never knew anything else, what nobody else was doing. Nothing was explained to us all. It was only what we were doing. We never knew what anyone else in the airborne was doing. what any of the seaborne are doing or what was happening. All we knew, we were doing this, and that was all we knew about.
And what was to be your own personal role in the attack?
Well, shall we say, we took off from Tarrant Rushton at 23:59 hours, double British summer time, on the 5th of June of 1944. We had to get up to 6,000 feet because we went over in a bomber fleet. So they had to fly us along the south coast till we got as far as Worthing. And then at Worthing we joined this bomber fleet, which went over up over towards Cobourg, because I gather afterwards I found out that the RAF, in the times that they'd been over there, they'd found there was a little bit of a gap in the flak guns, because from Wistram to Cobourg was all marshy ground, so they did not think, probably, they didn't think probably flak guns were there, so they got this bit of a gap. There was flak coming up as we went over there, and we were released over Cobourg about, you know, 6,000 feet, and immediately everything went silent. There was quite a lot of singing and chattering as waves as we went over, till John Howard said, "Quiet, they'll hear you." So everything went quiet, and then when he went twang, when you knew you'd been released, it certainly went quiet. And we dropped about 1,000 feet. I mean, we didn't know who was in the front. We never saw the glider pilots. We didn't know who they were. And then we went down, turning first round to the right and round to the left. Then all of a sudden we hit the ground. Well, we lost the wheels straight away because they jettison the wheels once you land on that particular ground. And we were then sailing along on a skid, on a metal skid underneath. And all of a sudden there was all these sparks flying. We thought we were being fired at, but understood nobody seemed to be getting hit. But it was a metal skid which was catching on flints and that on the stone, on the ground, which was sending all these sparks out till we came to this sudden bang as we came to a stop. And it turned out we'd finished up about 47 yards from the actual objective we were supposed to take. Now my section's job was to go over on the right hand side of the bridge, straight out, because we had to, should have been the brain gunner in first, and then me, and then our section, because they wanted the brain gunners out first, obviously. Anyway, so after we, you know, we get a bit shook up, but anyway, we pulled ourselves together, and out we went. Bill Gray, who was my brain gunner, and I was in charge of him, and off we went. But it turned out my section's job was to go over on the right-hand side of the bridge, which we did. Halfway over the bridge, I realised that Bill Gray should be in front of me. So I stepped aside. I said, "Come on, Bill, you should be in front of me." And he stepped over, because you don't want a boat firing it from the hip with a brain gun if you're in front of him. And so...
Tom Packman, Reel 2.